KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to KBOO, independent radio since 1968. Support our station and fight the status quo by donating to our spring membership drive, now through May 25th. During our last week, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $20,000, thanks to a group of anonymous donors. Click on the red button on the top corner of the app to donate. Thanks. KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's board of directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
If you stop to listen, you can hear their hearts beating loud. Keep those California Indians down.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. Today on American Indian Airwaves, Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and the Palestinians over 200 days later. We'll speak with a longtime Jewish musician, poet, and organizer in Chicago on the work that he and others are doing to stop the massacre and genocide taking place in Palestine against the Palestinian peoples. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone blue air in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
Today on American Indian Airwaves, Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and Palestinians over 200 days later. As of April 23rd of 2024, at least 34,183 Palestinians have been killed. More than 77,000 have been wounded, and over 8,000 are missing, with over 50% of all Palestinian homes have been destroyed as a result of Israel's attacks on Gaza since October 7th of 2023. Meanwhile, common diseases such as hepatitis and meningitis, to name just a few, are rapidly spreading throughout Gaza. In fact, it's estimated that 15 people are killed, 6 are children, every hour in Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, at least 487 Palestinians have been killed, more than 4,800 have been injured, and over 7,350 have been arrested since March of 2024. The death toll in Israel from Hamas's October 7th attacks stands at 1,139, with dozens still held captive in Gaza. Today on American Indian Airwaves, executive producer and co-host of American Indian Airwaves, Marcus Lopez and myself have the honor and pleasure to speak with Adam Gutlib, who's a Jewish musician, poet, and organizer based in Chicago, Illinois. He's also cantor with the Zidek Chicago, an anti-Zionist synagogue. He joins us for the hour to discuss what is happening at the grassroots level in organizing the peace movement to stop Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and Palestinians now over 200 days later. And now the interview.
Now, we speak before about some authors about Palestine, gave a little history on that, and we looked at that in a sense of giving people a little bit, especially Native people, non-Native, about the very, not only complicated, but she has a very interesting, to say the least, about Palestine. But Adam, from your point of view, why don't you give, first of all, some of the opening statements you would like to share with our listeners?
Sure. Well, it's a real honor to be here. I feel like to be in dialogue with the Native community right now is so important. And I am really active in the Jewish community here in Chicago in a number of ways. And I'm, as you said, a musician and a poet and activist. I will also say I'm a revolutionary, and I'm a cantor, which is a musical clergy member or faith leader at a synagogue here in Chicago called Tzedek Chicago, which means justice in Hebrew. It's a Jewish congregation founded back in 2015 on intentional core values of solidarity, justice, equity. And last year at this time, we went through a collective process of discussion and voting as a whole synagogue community and amended our core values statement to make it clear that we are an anti-Zionist synagogue. And as far as we know, we're one of, if not the only synagogues to take that particular stance and step, although certainly we're not alone in anti-Zionist Jewish organizing and community. There are, of course, anti-Zionist Jewish communities all over the world and have been as long as Zionism has existed, which is not that long, 150 years at most. And, Jewish tradition is, as we know it, is at least 2,000 years old, with rich prehistory going back another 1,000 years or more before that. And, everything that I love about Jewish tradition, as well as, other parts of my own cultural inheritance. My mom was actually raised Catholic, so I identify as interfaith. But what I love about these traditions is the way that they offer guidance for understanding ourselves in relation to the process of liberation for all peoples and to the oppressed. And, we're coming up on the festival of Passover next week, which is the time when we particularly remember our central story of liberation and our responsibility to stand in solidarity with the oppressed and to struggle for liberation. And So I'm really proud to be a part of Tzedek Chicago. I'm also a part of the Jewish Fast for Gaza, which has been fasting every week on Sundays since October 7th to call for a ceasefire and organizing and, organizing fundraisers for causes to feed the people and especially the children of Gaza. And that actually has a long history, too, but we reignited the fast in October. And, I'm with a lot of other organizing collectives and groups, but my main form of activism is really, as an artist, as a musician, as a poet. I have a band, and I've also been organizing a community project called Songs for Ceasefire, which has been just trying to meet the musical needs of the movement here in Chicago and to some extent, produce content that can be shared online and on social media too. So, yeah, there's a little bit about me that feels a little chaotic and jumbled, but we'll get into more stuff, I'm sure.
Well, one of the things is, especially when we talk to the author of The 100 Years War in Palestine, The History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance in 1917, to 2017, even though it is an older book, that he mentioned that the beginning, Yusuf Dara, who was most of his compatriots in Palestine, on the ambitions of a nascent Zionist movement then. And he indicated a letter of Yusuf Dara to Theodore Herzl. Mm-hmm. And about discussing that, the Zionist idea would sow dissensions among Christians, Muslims, and Jews, even there, even during the letter they presented in 1899. And wow. So this particular, when people talk about Zionism, people don't understand, I don't think, and we're trying to get a root of the matter is, it's not the Jewish people per se, but the Zionism. Could you please, Adam, how do you differentiate? I think a lot of people mix it up. Please talk to our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important point, and I think those of us who are anti-Zionist or non-Zionist Jews have an important role to play here in educating people, especially in the so-called USA, about this point, because there has been so much misinformation, decades, you know, over 75 years of cultural kind of misinformation and brainwashing. And then just, you know, in October, our Congress passed a resolution repeating what every president has said, including, you know, Biden and Obama and, you know, all of their crew, that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. This is, in fact, historically false, it's inaccurate, and it's important that people understand that Zionism has never represented all Jews. Zionism is a political movement that came about, you know, around 150 years ago and gained a lot of momentum in the period leading up to and through World War II. And it wasn't until after World War II that, you know, Zionism came to be something that was even somewhat mainstream in Jewish communities globally. But Zionism is basically the political movement for a, you know, ethno-state, a nation-state that has a Jewish ethnic and cultural majority. And, you know, it's important to name here that while there are reasons why this movement gained in popularity, and the most obvious one, of course, being the collective trauma of the Holocaust and the destruction of European Jews by the Nazis in the 30s and into the 40s in the 20th century, actually, you know, Judaism as we know it is a 2,000-year-old tradition that grew out of diaspora, out of Jews living in communities all over the world. And really, you know, there have been many Jews since, you know, this idea began who have said, no, actually, we don't need or want a state with a modern army and, you know, have to enforce it with border walls and weapons to be Jewish. That's not what being Jewish is all about, and especially not a settler colonial state that requires us to displace millions of people and essentially initiate what we are now seeing in 2024 as the logical conclusion of that process, which is genocide. And I think that's a point where the Native community and indigenous peoples of, you know, so-called North America, of Turtle Island, and all over the Americas and all over the world also have a lot to teach us, because ultimately Zionism betrays its own promise to keep Jewish people safe. And if we even take that as the project of the State of Israel, let alone the fact that this was really a proxy state set up by the Western colonial powers of, you know, Britain and the U.S. and other Western European powers, even if we imagine that the real purpose of the State of Israel was to keep Jewish people safe and provide a secure and safe homeland, we have to conclude that that project has failed, because to always have to enforce safety with guns and prisons and a military, you know, techno state such as the so-called State of Israel, you know, creates an unstable, untenable situation. And we have to imagine how to disarm and dismantle this state for the sake of everyone's safety. We have to imagine, how do we democratize this state? We have to accept what human rights organizations have been saying for years, what Palestinians have been saying for decades, that this is an apartheid state, that, you know, it is not a democracy in any way. And we need to ask ourselves, how do we create a society that actually protects children and families and people, no matter what their ethnicity, race, or religion? And then again, I think we have to ask ourselves some similar questions here and follow the leadership of Native voices here, just as we follow the leadership of Palestinian voices there.
That is so interesting, your particular statement, because of the fact that many people look at that and respond to the Middle East as a knee-jerk, especially the mass media. They don't look at the history. And I would say, Adam, that even since the Papal Bull Declaration by the Pope and the Pope Declaration of the Inquisition of the world, as well as the Jewish people back in the 1500s. So mm-hmm. we can see it's not a recent item as far as Jewish people and the plight of Jewish people. At the same time, to differentiate. And I think, thank you for your words, because a lot of people within the institutions, as well as in the judicial, even Congress and local communities, have looked at this in the sense of either for your Palestinians or you're for the Zionists, or you're for the Palestinians, and therefore you're with the terrorists. And I think that's...
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Adam Gottlieb, a Jewish musician, poet, and organizer based out of Chicago, Illinois. And he's also a cantor with the Zedek and Anti-Zionist Synagogue. We're speaking on Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and Palestinians over 200 days later. And now back to the interview.
If that could be even presented to one person, you know, that they're presenting it in the mass media, in my opinion, and that this particular thing is something that reminds me of the militarization, military-industrial complex, and humanity. Talk about, if you will, this question of war and peace as it relates to, like you said, some of the lessons, like what Mr. Khalidi talked about, was that the issue of any negotiations, even back a decade ago, that we need to reopen all critical issues created by the 1948 war and the close in Israel's favor in 1967 mm-hmm. by the UNSC 242 and the 1947 UNGA 181, the partition borders and its corpus separendum, proposal for Jerusalem, and return and compensate of refugees and the political national civil rights of Palestinians inside Israel. I'm thinking about the equal rights of a lot of Palestinians inside Israel. Talk about that for us. And I know it's a long statement, but these negotiations have not changed anything. Nobody, Israeli state is ignored, a lot of the UN, but at the same time, United States had ignored the history of that area and the history since 1948 about the ethnic cleansing process that Israel as a state has been doing with the Palestinians since that time. Talk about ethnic cleansing in Palestine, if you will, and talk about I just read about what can we expect as far as a resolution from your point of view. Mm-hmm. Talk about humanity, talk about peace.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. What rich and big questions and conversation. If you'll allow me to, I want to just go back and add one more thing to, you know, the last statement that I made as far as, you know, kind of laying out the context for all of this. And, you know, when we're thinking about the history and origins of Zionism, we have to start with the painful and ironic reality that actually Zionism's allies have always been largely anti-Semitic. And that remains, of course, true to this day, where now we live in a time where the most Zionists aren't even Jewish, but Christian, and the evangelical Christians essentially have a fantasy of all the Jews going to Israel and then, you know, getting killed and going to hell when the rapture happens, and they want to hurry that up along, and that's why they want all the Jews in Israel. But even when we go back to 1917, the Balfour Declaration, if we look at who Arthur Balfour was and what he was concerned about, you know, he is quoted as talking about the evils of the Jewish community and immigration in Europe, and he was looking for a solution to this. And so I start with that, because to get to your question about ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and the, you know, ultimate outcome or solution for peace and justice, I think we have to reckon with this fact that, you know, this ethnostate called Israel was really, you know, made by colonial powers out of a desire to essentially ghettoize the Jewish population and use them as a kind of buffer and a, you know, economic and military outpost in the region of the Levant and the Middle East. And this is, you know, kind of the beginning of the conflict, that we have essentially two populations that were exploited in different ways and kind of set up to fight each other. And we have, you know, the kind of European, the traumatized European Jewish population set up to do this military labor, exploited for their own military labor by these larger colonial powers. And it, what's so, so tragic is that, you know, Ashkenazi Jews might have moved to Palestine in a good way, right, as native folks say, like in a way that was not about, you know, weaponizing their identity and their culture and language to exclude people, but actually, you know, immigrating and harmonizing and integrating as they had done in every other, you know, part of the world. And actually, the Arab world was much kinder historically to Jews than the European world. It's as if, you know, I've heard scholars and folks active in the movement talk about how European Jews learned historically the exact opposite lesson that they might have and should have learned from their own experience of oppression and persecution in Europe. They basically learned that, hey, the way that we are going to survive is we're going to be part of this white world, this white European world, and we're going to be the colonizers and we're going to be the oppressors. And if anyone's going to be in charge, we're going to be the ones in charge. Not seeing that it's really through solidarity that Jewish people have resisted and survived their own oppression for thousands of years by forming strong communities and resilient communities with, you know, other oppressed peoples and non-Jewish peoples in the lands that we have lived in. And so when we're looking at the last 75 to 100 years, you know, we're just seeing this constant process of ethnic cleansing, sometimes faster, sometimes slower, right? But what is it? You know, in 1948, in the matter of just weeks, 750,000 Palestinians displaced from their homes or something like that. And the goal of the Israeli state's policies have always revealed themselves to be this sort of ethnic cleansing and forced displacement. And the plans have come out now that that's what this current genocidal assault has been about. Really, Netanyahu's government used the October 7th attack as a kind of pretense for doing something that he had wanted to do anyway and had plans to do already, which was to completely force people out of their homes, essentially to finish the job they started in 1948. And so what do we do? How do we imagine peace and justice? You know, like so many things, that's a question that's going to take all of us. and especially those who are most impacted to solve. And it's not like I have the solution here. But I think we can talk about some bare minimum parameters. Like, everyone's got to have human rights. That starts with, you know, food, water, housing, and healthcare, and peace, and true safety. But it also means the dignity of being able to return to the home that you were forced out of. And this is, of course, where things get really tricky and complicated. But I think we have to imagine that we can move toward more democratic ways of seeing how this can happen. And that means that we have to talk seriously about a democratic state without special privileges. So I heard someone put it this way, that, like, you know, we can't really talk seriously about a two-state solution because we've seen how that has played out. They've been talking about this for decades, and the reality that has developed in that time is you have one apartheid settler colonial state, which has now become an openly fascist state with the most advanced, you know, military and surveillance technology used to control and imprison and murder and brutalize people. And we're talking not just about Gaza, but also about Palestinians in the West Bank and Jerusalem, as you've talked about. We talk about an apartheid system where people have unequal political and social rights. We need to get rid of all of that. It's against international law. It's illegal. We need to take international law seriously and start to imagine state beyond all of these, you know, privileges that the state of Israel has always, you know, been founded on. You know, this idea that just because I can show up and say, hi, I'm Jewish, I have a right, you know, to a so-called right to go to Israel, whereas someone, you know, whose family was forced out of their homes, who still has the key to their home, can't simply return there because they're Palestinian, is just against all sense of human decency. And so we need to return to human decency. We need to start by talking about what do all human beings deserve, just for being human, and move in that direction and start disarming this state of Israel, but also all states, you know, especially the really entrenched superpower states. Those of us here in the U.S., our taxes are paying for this genocide, and they're also paying for our hundreds of military bases around the world, and we need to stop our government from just building up the death and murder apparatus and start investing in life supporting and sustaining systems, you know, here as well as there. So that's got to be the message, you know, everywhere, like peace over war, life over death, you know, build hospitals, don't bomb hospitals, right?
Adam, I have a question for you, and thank you for earlier in clarifying, you know, all these terms that often get conflated and commingled together. And, you know, even when we talk about the state of Israel, you know, there's this assumption that, you know, all Israelis are Jewish, when in fact a quarter of the population is not. But nevertheless, the critique of the state of Israel falsely gets characterized as being, you know, anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. And, you know, as Marcus was saying, we interviewed Dr. Rashid Khalidi earlier about the parallels in settler colonialism, which you brought up earlier. And we're talking about the history of the land and, you know, and a historical legacy of policies and war and the displacement of Palestinian people to and the killing of Palestinian people throughout the region. But, you know, there's other forms of warfare. And, you know, I think of, you know, Israel's policy of keeping captive Palestinian ancestors, so Palestinians cannot culturally, right, perform, for lack of a better term, perform or live in accordance to traditional Palestinian cultural practices, and so how that Israel's policy there functions as another form of warfare. And I think of, you know, the struggles of indigenous peoples here and trying to get their ancestors and other sacred items and forms of cultural patrimony returned back so they can be, you know, returned back to Mother Earth. And I was wondering, maybe you can speak to, you know, the other, and we talk about peace and the history there, you know, speak to the culture and how, you know, culture is attacked as a form of warfare, not just the people and the people being displaced and people being killed, but how culture connects to the struggles of for Palestinians and the goals to seek out peace everywhere.
Wow. Absolutely. Thank you. You know, this is a conversation that people are having that is so important that I think, you know, some of the most important voices in this conversation are, you know, from any community that has experienced genocide in some form. So we're talking about, that's actually a lot more people or peoples than, you know, the average person might realize, right? And, you know, again, it includes indigenous peoples all across the Americas, all across the world, really, because genocide isn't just the kind of destruction of people that happens really fast and furiously. It also includes the destruction of peoples that happens, you know, on a slower time frame. And when we look at the history of colonization here.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Adam Gottlieb, a Jewish musician, poet, and organizer based out of Chicago, Illinois. And he's also a cantor with the Zedek and Anti-Zionist Synagogue. We're speaking on Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and Palestinians over 200 days later. And now back to the interview.
When we listen to the voices of indigenous Americans and also like the Zapatistas in Southeast Mexico and, of course, Palestinians. And also when we as Jewish folks look at our own history, you know, we see exactly what you're talking about, that the way that we survive and resist oppression and genocide is through a connection to our culture, to our cultures and our languages and our faith traditions and our connection to the land and medicines and, you know, stories and poetry and music and art. You know, it's one of the most sickening things about what's happening in Gaza for the last 7 months is the targeting of cultural sites, of institutions of culture, of artists and poets, of libraries and universities and mosques and churches, and that we see this as a deliberate and intentional policy of the Israeli state, which also made it illegal for over two decades for Palestinians to wave their own flag in their own country, right? And so I think, you know, we as cultural workers have an important role here, and all of us, you know, have an important role to play in bearing witness not only to, you know, Palestinian death and destruction, but to Palestinian life and language and culture, you know. And that is also something that we hear again and again from the Palestinian community, is that they have learned through their experience to center not death but life, and why it's so important to just protect the basic rights of people to have a life, to have a family, to have, you know, schools, to have art, to have music, to have cultural institutions, and to be able to pray and practice their, you know, faith traditions. Yeah, I'm not sure what else to say.
But Adam, you were hitting the nail on the head, you might say. It's not only the Palestinians, you know, also they're facing genocide through the world, but you're talking about many other peoples, Kurdish, where other people within what we call Abayala North, Abayala South. And that's why we're having a discussion about the moral obligation. The moral obligation is, how do we, let me talk about what happened with the Holocaust in Germany. That has a whole history in itself, especially with the fascists within the United States supporting many of the fascists within Nazi Germany, and during that time, a highlight. And then, in turn, and the voices speaking out, and we knew this stuff was happening. And at the same time, the hospitals in this area since 1948, it's just so parallel to what Benjamin Medley and David Stinnard and different historians talk about in back east, and Larry can go on for hours about the genocide of ethnic cleansing, they don't call it then, but of Native peoples, the whole colonial 13 colonies, and we don't teach each other that. And the war against the people, it's not only the war against, like a military, like you see on TV or something, it's different. It's about the collateral damage as women and children and elderly. And the different shrines, I think what Larry was getting to, what I interpreted, it was that within Israel as a state, even the beginning, there were a lot of villages and a lot of mosques and Christians that they were living together for thousands of years and then lived together, and they were culturally tied together. And the thing about it is that we can learn the lessons of that. We can learn the lessons of the moral obligation, especially with a lot of Native people in the military and a lot of our young people in the military. What are you fighting for? Well, actually, what are you fighting for? Because this escalation of the Middle East is something that, I could see it. It's not a surprise. So the generals and the military on all sides are preparing for, let's together sharpen our swords and, I order this from this country, then make those productions and whatnot. But the escalation, what's the moral obligation? And war is not only an absence of violence, but war is a sense of peace internally with people, internally with their families, internally with their communities. Talk about that, about the cultural, internal, really the moral obligation that the peace movement, we should be up in our demonstrations and up in our opinions and our mobilization about this tragedy of human beings, not only within, like we're talking about Palestine now, but within Ukraine, within the, within all areas of the world, within Mexico, within other areas in the world. This is terrible, this notion of violence. And lateral violence, violence about one community against another. Talk about that moral obligation that we have. You coming from a place of, you talked about Zionism. Talk about the culture, your culture, your belief systems, about the obligation that people should have across the board.
Yeah, I think I understand the question, and it's a really deep question, Marcus. Thank you, and both of you. Larry, your last question too. This is such a nourishing conversation for me. Yeah. I mean, at this point, we have to talk about things that cut across all, religious divisions and cultural divisions. We have to be talking about what is our moral obligation just as human beings to each other. You know, if we're going to talk about moral obligations, right? Like, and that is what time it is. Like, you can't look at what's happening in Gaza and not be stirred on that level of just, humanity. And being a human being is all it takes to know that this is wrong. But that's been true about so many crises, man-made disasters, forced poverty, forced scarcity, starvation, illness, mass incarceration, the whole sacrifice of our climate and our biosphere to the, profiteering interests of capital. All of these are, defining realities of our lifetimes, we who are alive, in this century. And all of that gives us a moral obligation to fight for peace, yes, on the most profound level, not just as the absence of war, but as the investment in life, right? And yeah, so it is time for, you know, all of us to kind of learn from the most serious peace activists, you know, like, you know, the civil rights movement, the freedom riders, you know, the groups like the Creative Voices for Nonviolence or Voices in the Wilderness, which is a Catholic founded peace activist group with, you know, longtime peace veterans like Kathy Kelly, you know, interfaith actions like the peace flotilla that first challenged the siege on Gaza 10 years ago, I think it was, and are now reforming again in this moment to try to deliver food into Gaza. Like, Kathy Kelly says, you know, those of us who seek peace need to be willing to take as many risks as those who are fighting wars, right? And I think there's some real serious truth to that that I'm still trying to figure out. What does that mean for me and my journey and my life? But yeah, I do know that I feel a sense of moral obligation to be in a kind of permanent state of solidarity and struggle with not just the people of Palestine, who I feel a particular sense of responsibility to as an American Jew, but to all oppressed and colonized and racialized and impoverished peoples of the world, you know. And I do think, like, ultimately we have to talk about a revolution, you know. Martin Luther King called it a revolution of values, right? And I think that's a good framework for thinking about a certain aspect of what revolution actually is. Like, we do have to just decide that taking care of each other as human beings and also our non-human relatives too, right? And the earth as a whole, right? That this is more important than allowing the 1%, as it were, to just continue to get richer and richer and richer. Why are we defending, you know, the rights of these few private individuals who are just, like, destroying the whole planet and people all over the world with their profit-seeking and power-seeking? Why are we allowing this to continue? We have the power here to stop it, to stop the war machine, and to start investing in life. I mean, here in Chicago, where I live, we have these growing tent encampments as asylum seekers continue to pour in from not just Latin America, but all over the world. And then Republican governors, you know, like Greg Abbott in Texas, to make some sort of, you know, political point or theater, are busing, you know, these folks seeking refuge and asylum to declared, self-declared sanctuary cities like Chicago. And sure enough, it's really testing the, like, infrastructure and political system here in Chicago, where we have a progressive mayor, but a very deeply divided and bureaucratic city government. And the result is we have huge numbers of people living in tents on the street, and we don't even, like, think about it twice when we walk past someone who clearly needs all sorts of help and services on the street. It's just become so normal in Chicago and in so many cities like Chicago to just ignore this reality. But I think we can start talking about, like, our moral obligation to each other right here at home, if we're going to talk about moral obligations, right? And then allow that to also be a foundation on which we, you know, extend that to wider and wider peoples. Because the same reason why children are getting bombed and starved in Gaza is the same reason why my neighbors here don't have houses, right? It's because the system isn't actually built to take care of people. The system is built to empower and enrich the ruling and owning elites. And that's the problem that we need to change. So, you know, we do need to break away from the two-party system. We do need a revolution. I don't have all the answers, but I know that's what we need, you know?
Adam, when you're talking about revolution and the peace movement, you know, there's been work done at, you know, at universities and colleges by, you know, students and student organizations and even faculty members, but there's been such a, you know, political backlash. I mean, you have campuses like in Columbia suspending chapters of the Students for Justice in Palestine and the Jewish Voice for Peace. You've had over 100 students arrested the other day at Columbia University. USC the other day canceled valedictorian graduation speech that was scheduled to be given by Anza Tabassum, who's a graduating senior and was selected, right, to give this speech. Yep. But you've had, you know, faculty, you know, losing their jobs or being suspended or disciplined, you know, in harsh ways. And, you know, there's this kind of institutional censorship in tenor at colleges and universities, very similar to what happened after 9/11. So it's just your thoughts on that as part of this, you know, the work that you're doing there in Chicago and throughout the areas and really trying to foster, you know, a greater sense of moral obligation for peace and justice and dignity for all life. And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Adam Gottlieb, a Jewish musician, poet, and organizer based out of Chicago, Illinois. And he's also a cantor with the Zedek and Anti-Zionist Synagogue. We're speaking on Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and Palestinians over 200 days later. And now back to the interview.
Yes. So important. What you're talking about is really kind of like the front lines of, you know, the struggle for ideas and consciousness. And it is truly terrifying to see our institutions of higher learning just bend to what we have to admit is a more and more fascist or fascistic movement, not just in politics, but in the way that, you know, corporations control everything about our political system. And that's been a problem that's been getting worse for a long time, for many decades, you know, and we have to go back and look at, you know, Citizens United, which was what, in the 2000s, and, you know, other landmarks like that to understand how did we get here. Ultimately, a university is a kind of corporation, and it is seeking, you know, if not profit in the strict for-profit sense, it's seeking to protect its shareholders and its donations from donors and all of that. Whether we're talking about the nonprofit system or the for-profit market, the same basic economic laws of capitalism apply across the board. And we have to think critically about, you know, why this is happening when just a handful of corporations own the vast majority of media, and they're all tied up in fossil fuel and war industries and the U.S. empire around the world, which of course includes Israel in such a huge way, the state of Israel. That's how we get to this situation where our universities that are supposed to be sanctuaries for free thinking and freedom of speech, where students are given resources and tools to expand their minds, not censored and disciplined for engaging in critical discussion and raising valid criticisms that are backed by, you know, evidence and objective evidence and facts.
So I would remind listeners, we're speaking with Adam Gottlieb, who's a Jewish musician, poet, organizer based out of Chicago. And Marcus and I had the honor and pleasure to speak with them and the work that he's doing. And we want to just stress and emphasize that if you appreciate what we're doing here on American Indian Airwaves and what all the volunteer programmers and staff bring to KPFK, that we ask you to continue to support KPFK financially in a variety of different ways. You can visit the kpfk.org website. You know, you click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget. You can agree to donate a dollar amount per month and become a KPFK Sustainer Circle member. There are premium items for a specific dollar amount that you can peruse through and select. There's the KPFK limited edition logo poster designed by Shepherd Ferry in honor of KPFK's 60th anniversary. It's a $65 donation in recognizing the 65 years of KPFK's legacy in bringing you unheard, marginalized, community-based voices and indigenous voices across Turtle Island. We want to stress the importance of the work that we do here at American Indian Airwaves and KPFK. And if you appreciate what we do, please support the station. You can visit the kpfk.org website. You can call 818-985-5735, 818-KPFK. And just remember, this is 100% listener-supported community radio, community podcasting, and you can't hear these voices in the corporate legacy and digital media scape. And so what we bring you is truly an alternative. You don't hear advertisements. We don't have corporate underwriters. What we have is you, the listener, and your financial support here on American Indian Airwaves and KPFK. Marcus?
Well, Larry, this is the time where we go out and talk to our listeners and with them, and we appreciate them listening to the American Indian Airwaves. I want to take a different angle. This is a fundraiser. This is, you know, pledge time, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And we have interviewed many people in the front lines. This particular interview with Adam is a unique one because we wanted to educate and stimulate discussions around the situation with the Palestine, the genocide of Palestinian peoples, and the ethnic cleansing very much parallels to indigenous peoples. Right. And a lot of indigenous peoples, native people, first people, don't even know that, mm-hmm. that this is the same type of scenario. So people within the organizations, nonprofits, NGOs, in the military, they got to know that we talked about the moral obligations. And let's get back to basics, Larry. Moral obligations support KPFK. KPFK and independent radio stations. Some programs are wonderful. Some other programs are, they're the taste of the public, which is really eclectic out there in the public. We here on the American Indian Airways want to propose to you that besides the premiums, you go on the website, on the market, just put on Prescott, just put on another book, and all the different programs here on KPFK. A lot of it is volunteers and like Beautiful Struggle and things like Jerry Silva does, and the prisoners and that whole realm and that segment of our community that's behind the iron bars. Phone this number again. 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, plastic, and also what you said, Larry, monthly sustainers, and we have tote bags, we have, I think, the beautiful stickers, you know, they can put on your car, and want to remind people that we're in the transition, we want to make the station better, and with this particular pledge, you help us make the station that much better and keep American Indian Airwaves alive. Larry.
Thank you, Marcus. That's so true in this time of transition and looking to rebirth and reconstitute a new KPFK for the next generation is so important. And it's important to understand, too, is that, you know, what we do here on American Indian Airwaves and what other programmers do as well, and in bringing those unheard, those marginalized voices. There's no censorship on KPFK, and the corporate, you know, legacy and digital media, you know, censorship always is abundant and abounds, especially when it comes to the issues that we bring here on American Indian Airwaves, the critiques and the struggles against settler colonialism, the forms of violence perpetuated against Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations, against Mother Earth. And we are always bringing those critiques forward to you, the listeners, and we need that. We need that. We need people to hear those unheard voices.
Larry, we need the people to phone 818-985-5735, right? 818-985-5735, like you said, and also kpfk.org.
It's so true, Marcus. And, you know, we need people to support us, to support KPFK. Like you're saying, visit the kpfk.org website, click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget, become a monthly Sustainer Circle member, agree to donate a dollar amount of your choice on a monthly basis, or go through the carts and peruse through the all the premium items. Are a way of saying thank you. Each premium item has its designated dollar amount that you can see on the website. Pick something up. Pick up the Shepherd Fairies or 60th anniversary KPFK poster for $65. Pick up a tote bag for $50. There's bumper stickers, there's music packages, and so much more. But what is important is that if you appreciate what we do here on American Indian Airwaves, here on KPFK, continue to financially support us. Call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or visit the kpfk.org website and click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget. Marcus?
But if all you Native peoples out there, you know, Southern Cal, you know, and other social justice people, folks talk about re-indigenizing, well, support American Indian Airways. We're talking about, you know, decolonizing. Well, this is part of it. Getting the information first, the information we provide you, and get educated as far as what our leaders, what our people in the front lines are talking about that we covered here in the American Indian Airways. We do it for you. And so pick up the phone. Go to your computer, put your wallet with your ears, you know, whatever the case may be, like Corey used to say, give to us that gift of money, and where the gift of money is translated in the gift of freedom, of justice, and of equality that we're speaking about, you know, and self-determination for Native peoples, First Peoples, and the challenge we have in this time, especially this time in KPFK, and also this time, worldwide struggles out there that the media, like you said, Larry, the mass media and the control of that media by corporate capitalists, we have the ability and the obligation to reach out and phone 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 and kpfk.org.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Adam Gottlieb, a Jewish musician, poet, and organizer based out of Chicago, Illinois. He's also a cantor with the Zedek Chicago, an anti-Zionist synagogue. He's speaking on Israel's war and genocide on Palestine and Palestinians over 200 days later, and his work is part of the peace movement. And that concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest for the hour, Adam Gottlieb. A special thank you to our musical guests, Aragon Star, Koopa Aina, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
justify why your freedom manifests on their graves. And the blood never comes clean from their guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during the last week of our spring membership drive, your support can go even